Beaming out across the galaxy, this is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, tonight we have a wonderful show for you. We are talking with Laird Scranton. And although something like comparative cosmology might sound a little technical for you, trust me, we're going to be getting deep into your soul, your spirit, and the understanding of life on planet Earth. I mean, as a matter of fact, we're going to be digging into quantum entanglement that goes back 12,000 years. So get ready, folks. Get your cup of coffee. Get whatever you need to sit back, get ready, and relax, because this is going to be an epic show that takes you places you had no idea you would go by studying ancient cosmologies of Dogon, Maori, Egyptian, and getting deep into how life on planet Earth is going through these cycles, aeons, as the magicians would call it, and how this formed the natural cycle of life on planet Earth, bringing in even matriarchy to patriarchy. So please welcome to the Free Zone, Laird Scranton.
Hey, thank you very much. I really appreciate your inviting me on. I'm looking forward to this. This could be a very interesting discussion.
I think it is, Laird. I think you and I are more alike than we have known. And, that our science is fairly similar.
That's great.
Well, I thought we'd start talking a little bit of comparative cosmology with this black 30-ton sarcophagus found in Alexandria. Because I'll tell you, Laird, when I first saw the imagery and saw the story, you know, of course, the curse that was supposedly going to come along with the opening this massive black sarcophagus, well, the fact that it was described as 9 feet long, believe me, I was thinking giants.
Yeah, I was too.
Like, well, I hope they open this before I get to talk to Laird, is what I was thinking.
Well, that was a pretty interesting find. And, you know, I could think that, well, maybe that just happened to be the cheapest coffin they had that day.
Yeah. Well, what struck me, Laird, is that I study Freemasonic ritual very deeply. My dad was a Mason, and it really intrigued me when I started to discover how many tendrils these Masons had into everything. And I kind of used comparative cosmology to identify corporate logos and recognize the signs and symbols inside of Freemasonry as they are represented in all of these corporate logos.
Uh-huh.
And of course, all that fit. And sure enough, I could go and even look and see, oh yeah, absolutely, this man was a Mason that started McDonald's or started, you know, whichever corporate logo I was looking at.
Right.
So in order to understand any of that, you really got to know what happens inside of these dark, hoary lodges and what happens when you walk in and present yourself of your own free will and accord and go through the Masonic ritual of being raised to a master Mason. And in this story, in this ritual, as you walk into the lodge, now we think this ritual has been performed for thousands of years, over and over and over again in all of these amazing temples. And these people that lead us go through this. Now, in this ritual, you go through a death and resurrection ritual. And what happens is you pretend to be this character, Hiram Abiff, right?
Uh-huh.
And as you are brought through this ritual, you are murdered by three ruffians. And each of the ruffians has a symbolic murder weapon, like a mallet that clubs you in the skull, having your throat cut, things of that nature as you go through each of the ruffians. And this is part of even the catechisms of Freemasonry. So when they open that black sarcophagus and they turned out to be three rebels, three warriors, three ruffians.
Uh-huh.
One having a mallet block to his forehead, and the others not really being able to tell because of all the red sewage inside.
Right.
It immediately made me think of Masonic ritual, and had they found the tomb of Hiram Abiff, was there an acacia tree planted over this 30-ton black sarcophagus? And was this the true story behind the three ruffians that were actually instead themselves murdered in these ways? And I think that's a very interesting way to start to look into comparative cosmology when you can apply, when you're seeing, you know, Masonic ritual to these three rebels, ruffians, warriors, sacrificed or dead in the same way that you would through these rituals. So that's where I went with this. But then, of course, now we have some 21,000 people that have signed a petition to drink this red sewage found inside of this thing. And if you've seen the pictures, I don't understand this. And I know that this relates to your cosmology understanding of us reaching our basest, most material plane that a human has been in. And,
How willing humanity is to drink the sewage these days.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. I mean, are we, you know, and when you start looking through these cosmologies and you are discovering that we are hitting that base plane, I mean, what says it more than wanting to drink some red raw sewage out of I don't get it, Larry.
Yeah, I don't really get it either. I mean, I can see why people were intrigued by the sarcophagus, how they didn't want to wait to open it, how they understood just by the way it presented that it was going to be it looked like a significant thing. I'm just sorry that the contents had been so deteriorated by the hole in the side of the sarcophagus.
Yes. We could have learned something. I remember when they announced they had found the tomb of Osiris.
Yes.
And then they had to change it to the Osiris shaft, which, of course, sits next to all of the obelisks in its verbiage. Not to get too too much into that, but yeah.
Well, it's always interesting to find what looks like a link, a historical link to something that has been presented as a myth.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, that's what took Schliemann to Troy, you know, was the willingness to accept that there might be more to this than just a myth and pursuing it. That's sort of the way my study works, comparative cosmology works, is it begins with resemblances. And then my job is to try to test the reasonableness of comparisons.
Right. Right. Exactly. And good science it is, too, and very important. And then taking you to most intriguing places and understanding that in 10,000 BC, they had the knowledge that CERN is now trying to express. And
right.
you got to wonder if that was the moment that set the pace for the new technocracy that we currently live in, with punching holes into the other dimension with CERN, AI, robots. You know, where we're at right now seems
right.
to have been set all the way back to the beginning of your studies, going all the way back to ancient Turkey and laying the foundation of where we're at now. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not sure that I would agree that that was an intention of the tradition back then.
Not
but
the
I can,
intention, but yeah,
right.
the effect. Yeah.
But one of the effects, possibly, yeah. And I think there are more recent developments that have sort of taken us that direction, but it's all the same stuff.
Because it does seem like humanity was set on this course. I mean, to reach this point where we are making chips and AI and even ionospheric heaters and particle accelerators.
Right, and we can see that the symbolism way back at 10,000 BC was aimed at a technologically capable audience.
Right.
And it's hard to argue that, you know, the cultures in that era actually used or understood the technology, but they were expected to be able to carry it forward. And that's what all the metaphors and symbolism is about, is finding a way to correctly transmit technological concepts in a way that are going to hold together.
And span that length of time, right?
Right, and that span of time, yes. And also, there's an issue because a metaphor only works if it resonates with the person that you're using it with. So from that distance, not knowing what the frame of reference of a technological society might be thousands of years later, there was some guesswork involved with what metaphor is going to do it. And they end up restating the same thing in multiple metaphors as if, hoping that one of them is going to stick to the wall.
Well, how did you feel about the Tao of Physics?
I think that it's certainly true that Chinese traditions, I wrote a book about Chinese cosmology, that Chinese traditions like Taoism rest on the same basic principles and basic symbology as the rest of this, the Egyptian, the Vedic Hindu, Buddhism, Dogen, Tibetan, that all of these traditions have signature elements associated with them that show that they all originated as one thing. So if the rest of it ties to deep science, so does Taoism.
So we're looking at a situation where we have these coded messages that are showing us an expression of the universe that starts with these simple symbols, a five-pointed star, a line with a curved line through it. Things, and then I guess what I was really leaning towards to begin with was the idea that these messages were transmitted. These messages, perhaps like we're seeing in the modern world of Masons doing rituals inside of lodges, that there was some form of communication going back, say, Göbekli Tepe, that would then transmit itself to those able to receive. Is that
Yeah, it depends on which culture you talk to about it. I'm in the fortunate position that I have two matching symbolic systems, the Buddhist system associated with the stupa and the Dogen cosmology associated with the shrine called a granary. And they're given in completely different languages. So we know that it's not likely that one culture just adopted the other one's tradition wholesale because they didn't take any of the words with them. It expressed differently. Now, the Buddhists, okay, they're both documentedly ancient. The Buddhist system was documented around 400 BC, and the Dogen is expressed in Egyptian words that went out of use by around 750 BC. The Dogen cultural traditions date back to around 3000 BC. So we know these are ancient traditions. Now, you get to the modern day and you talk to modern authorities on Buddhism. And the Dogen are still a living tribe, so you talk to a modern Dogen priest, and they understand their symbolic systems in pretty much matched ways. You can use one to cross-check the other. So what that means is two different groups successfully managed to keep this very complicated system of symbols and meanings and transmit it pretty much whole down through thousands and thousands of years down to the present day. Now the problem is that the Buddhists flatly say that their most sacred symbols were gifted to humanity by a non-human source. The Dogen say not only was it non-human, it was also originally non-material. Now, as a researcher, my job is to try to cross-check what these cultures are saying. It leaves me sort of in a hard situation because I can postulate that both cultures managed to keep all of these details straight, intimate details straight, for thousands of years, and they get down to the very last one, who they got the system from. That they, I can say that they both misremembered it in matching ways, and I throw out the piece of information about non-humans. Or I can postulate that they kept that last detail straight also, and now I have to allow for the possibility of a non-human source. But the intriguing piece to me is the Dogen piece that says that flatly says that this was originally a non-material source, but acting in a material frame. You see an example of that in the Old Testament with Moses on the mountain, that there are strict cautions being given to the Israelites to stay away from the mountain. Don't go too close. There are bad effects that could accrue here if you approach too closely. There's clearly something happening in the physical realm that's connected non-materially. And that's what the Dogen are representing. They're saying that it's not simply a matter of communication from a non-material side to the material side, that there was actual physical interaction on the material side. Now, that seems like a wild idea until you stop and consider that the official viewpoint of physicists is that matter begins in a wave-like state that's virtually massless. And relativistic mass is sort of imbued as acceleration is imbued to energy. And so the official view on how things happen, how material forms emerge, is that they begin non-materially. So the Dogen viewpoint isn't really a radical viewpoint. It's really a mainstream one. It's just that we have a tough time understanding how could it reasonably be that something that was originally non-material could take form materially and somehow interact with us.
Right. And it leads to that concept of, let's say, ancient aliens, where people think that some race came down here and suddenly dominated planet Earth and changed everything. I disagree with that idea.
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. I see signs that there may be an intermix of influences here. But the one that I associate with the cosmology isn't an off-planet influence. It's an off-universe influence.
Right.
And there's a perspective from which that actually makes sense. That's really what my book, Seeking the Primordial, is about. It's because the foundation for explaining how it's reasonable is book length, I had to write a book to try to set it out in a logical sequence so that it makes sense to people, where each step along the way you can say intuitively, yeah, that makes sense. I see how this connects to that.
Is this anywhere near morphogenesis? Like, are these beings becoming more material over time or appearing? I guess I keep thinking about the Dogon and the Nomo, and whether or not they were actually sliming up out of the water to teach them the secrets of Sirius.
Right.
Or whether that was more of a descriptive idea of what was going on and using symbolic language.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background here and try to put you in the mindset of how this works. The tradition for me rests on a philosophy called Samkhya, which is an archaic cosmology. It's a companion to yoga, and it begins in... it looks like it takes its beginnings in the Fertile Crescent region, which is the same area as Göbekli Tepe, and it's transmitted down through India into Egypt around 4000 BC through a group called the Shakti cult. It's transmitted down into Palestine, and then it looks like across to the United Kingdom around 4000 BC. Samkhya says universes form in pairs, non-material and material. And there's a cycle of energy that between these two universes that's as critical to life in the universe as the natural water cycle is to life on the planet. The natural water cycle is water evaporating to form clouds, rising up over the mountains, and then creating rain that flows back to the sea. Without that cycle of water, we don't have life. Same thing in the universe. Without this cycle of energy between these universes, we don't have life in the universe. The idea is that energy scrolls from one universe to the other universe out to a certain extent, and then it reverses itself and scrolls back. This is the dynamic of what we call a dipole. Now, as it turns out, it's not just energy that's scrolling, it's also mass. And Einstein says, okay, what that means is that one universe is becoming progressively less massive, and the other universe is becoming progressively more massive. Einstein says, when you make a thing more massive, you slow down its time frame. Time slows down. Conversely, as you make the other universe less massive, you're speeding up its time frame. Now, if you imagine this as sand in an hourglass, and all the sand begins in the top globe, and it trickles down into the bottom globe, there's a point in the middle where you have the same amount of sand in the top as you have in the bottom. We're talking about energy and mass with universes, that means that there's a point midway through this cycle where time frames equalize between the universes, and it becomes thinkable that it might be possible to cross from one to the other. Now, the idea that someone might have done that is upheld in a couple of different traditions pretty clearly. In Egypt, Okay, if you think of this cycle that scrolls one direction and then back the other direction as metaphorically as a year, in India they refer to it as the great year, then the point at which the equalization happens is the equinox of the year. At the equinox, okay, the Egyptian term for equinox was Kepher. Kepher was the dung beetle, which is represents the concept of non-existence coming into existence. In Judaism, there's a holiday at the equinox of the year called Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur. Same concept. At the other equinox in Judaism, you have a holiday called Passover. Passover, not Passover is the statement of what we're saying happens at the equinox, the ability to pass between universes. At the end of a traditional Jewish Passover Seder, they open a door to allow a non-material entity called Eliyahu to step inside. So they're physically enacting the thing I'm saying the energy implies has to happen at the equinox. So the perspective is that this equalization of time frame works the same way an airlock does in a submarine or in a spaceship. The reason you can't just step out of a spaceship is because the huge difference in pressure inside and outside would just explode you out the hatch. You need an airlock to equalize the pressure between the inside and the outside so you can step out without that explosive effect. Well, the equalizing of time frames works that same way, from the way I understand it. And so the Dogon are saying, okay, their term for their teachers is pneumo. In Egypt, that's pneuma. Pneuma is a compound word that means waves perceived. This is non-material, the non-material being perceived, perceptible. On the mountain in with Moses, we have the non-material expressing itself in a way that's perceptible. Now, the Dogon say their teachers were concerned about the bad effects that could accrue to us from being around them. And so their solution to that was to sequester eight tribes people in a remote location, instruct those eight people in civilizing skills and in concepts of cosmology. Basically, they're aiming at agriculture as far as the civilizing skills go. And then return those eight back to wherever they came from and let them teach everybody else. That's the dynamic that we see play out mythologically all over the world. Every culture has a tradition that eight mythical ancestors or emperors or gods or whatever came, wise men came to their culture in ancient times bringing civilizing skills.
Right. In Egypt, we had the Ennead,
Right, that's right.
the
Or the
fish and
Ogdoad,
reptilian,
right,
strangely enough.
or eight of the Ogdoad.
Right.
So
Oh, the
this
Octoad. Right,
is,
exactly.
so this this dynamic makes sense in terms of what the ancient cultures are representing happened.
Now,
So
strangely.
that's the basic the mindset. The mindset is the second piece of it that what we'll get to later is the motivation for why the non-material would want to do that.
Right. Yes, that's when it starts to really get interesting. And to think that this Octoad, the eight, were they were drawn as reptilian and fish beings, and that's been kind of a consistent symbolic message throughout all of this as well. Just that reptile fish thing. I don't know what to think of it, but certainly in ancient Egypt, that's what you see is the pairing of a fish-headed being and a serpent-headed being,
Yes, okay. Now, I was talking about whoever put this symbolic system together at 10,000 BC was aiming at targeting an audience that was technological thousands of years in the future and not certain what metaphors to use to connect to that. And so they framed a series of four-stage metaphors. I'll try to explain what those metaphors do. The one you're probably familiar with or most familiar with is water, fire, wind, and earth. You can see those as four states of matter. You can see those as four stages of the creation of matter. Water is wave, matter in its wave-like state. Fire is an act of perception or energy. Wind is vibration and earth is mass. Now, that pattern repeats itself again and again in a number of other metaphors. One of the metaphors is given in terms of the animal kingdom, and it runs from insects to fish to four-legged animals to birds. Now, these metaphors are not just metaphors. They're also a scale for us. It's sort of a graduated scale. So we know that by that scale, that Kepler, the dung beetle, who represents an insect, that his symbolism lies at the very beginning of the scale. He's an insect. We also know that Thoth, who represents the concept of language and the word, which is, and from the Dogon perspective, is mass completed. It's the completion of the formation of mass or matter. That falls at the far other end of the scale. So we also know, so okay, now Thoth had the head of a bird. Right. Kepler was an insect.
Right.
So we can use this metaphor to look at those animal-headed Egyptian deities and predict, based on what their head represents, one of those four categories, which category does it fall in, that's where their cosmological system is, symbolism is also going to fall. Another way to look at it is the Dogon at one point were wondering, sort of out of curiosity, where does humanity fall in terms of intellectual ability and capability compared to all the other potential life forms there are in the universe, and compared to the teachers who were teaching them? And where do their teachers fall? So the mythical teachers of the Dogon told them that Earth was the planet of the fishes. If we think of that scale, insects to fish to four-legged animals to birds, that says we're not the least capable that there is. We're about second on the scale. If you were working your way up, we're about, you know, we're in the second quarter of the continuum.
Right.
They represented themselves as the dog star. Sirius is associated with the non-material.
Right.
And so a dog is the third on that scale. It's saying we, the teachers, are not the ultimate be-all, end-all of intelligence in the universe, but we're a stage ahead of where you're at.
Right. Yes, the veneration for Sirius throughout Freemasonry and all of these different ancient cultures as well is shocking.
Yes,
it
is.
Yeah, it's the brightest star, but come on.
Well, the knee-jerk impulse is to think, well, the reason it's so important in all these traditions is because that's where the teachers came from.
Yes.
And it's easy to think that because symbolically, the sun is the icon of the material and Sirius is the icon of the non-material. But when you get down into the science of it and you realize that what the Dogon are representing are dynamics of how matter happens, stages of how matter is formed, and these are scientifically represented. These are scientifically credible representations of how the processes happen. And when you get down to the very bottom of the Dogon system, you realize that one of the underlying dynamics is the dynamic of virtual particles. And that these underlying dynamics are about a handful of them, and they play out in parallel on all upward scales of the process, from the quantum scale to the macrocosmic scale and probably beyond. Now, the dynamic of the two Sirius stars, one is a bright sun-like star and the other one is a small, dense, dark dwarf star, is a counterpart to the dynamic of virtual particles, which can produce a photon, which is like a bright star, and an electron, which is like a massive little dark star.
Right.
If you track the motion, okay, think of the orbit of two things as a circle. But if you consider that those two things are also moving through space at the same time, now when you track their dynamic, what you get is almost a literal representation of what virtual particles do.
Right.
So the reason, from my perspective, that Sirius has such significance for us in these ancient traditions is because it's a visual representation in our field of view of an extremely fundamental process in how this stuff works.
Right. Even though at that time they couldn't really see, I mean, we didn't know that the binary star was there, but the Dogon somehow did.
Right. Now, the Dogon also knew about another structure that we don't see.
Poe.
No, this is called, they call it the Chariot of Orion. Now, it's worth telling you the story about
Please.
how I found this. There's a Dogon myth about a character named Ogo. Ogo is the person who, the mythical character who's responsible for having created our universe, our material universe. Ogo plays the role of light in the Dogon mythology. And his counterpart in Egypt, there's a word Aku in Egypt that means light, and there's an Egyptian light god named Aku, who's a counterpart to Ogo. Now, one of the things that Ogo does is he measures out the universe in 8 billion steps. I know that most constructs of the cosmology have more are given more than one definition, and a cubit is one of those concepts. A cubit can be measured from the tip of the elbow to the tip of the middle finger, but it can alternately be measured as the average step or pace of a person. So when the Dogon myth says that Ogo measures out the universe in 8 billion steps, they're implying cubits. And I know that the universe is a lot bigger than 8 billion cubits. But one of the figures that's routinely tossed around when you ask how big the visible universe is, what you get back is 8 billion light years. So I thought, someone seems to be setting up a correspondence between cubits and light years. So I went to the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary and discovered that one of the term for cubit is a compound word, aku meh, based on that same aku, ogo, word. Aku meh literally means light measure. So
Light.
even the Egyptian hieroglyphic language is suggesting that we have an equivalence between cubits and light years. So then I ask, how do we know how big an Egyptian cubit was anyway? And I realize the way we know it is we inferred it from the size, the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid measures 440 cubits per side of its base and 280 cubits high. My friend Robert Bovall says that the three large pyramids at Giza are a reflection of the belt stars of Orion at 10,000 BC. If so, I'm sitting here with three pieces of information and nothing I can really do with them. So out of frustration, I'll go online, I go to Google, and I type in Orion 440 280 and press enter. And what I turn up is references to a spiraling birthplace of stars called Barnard's Loop that centers on the belt stars of Orion, but is so faint that we can't see it. You can only image it with time-lapse photography. The Dogon call it the Chariot of Orion. And it turns out when you image the spiral, it looks like the wheel of a chariot that Orion the Hunter is standing in. It measures 440 light years by 280 light years.
No way.
Now, the Dogon had carefully, the reason that Barnard's Loop is important to the Dogon is because they say it's the macrocosmic representation of a fundamental spiral of matter, the same way that the Sirius stars, I'm saying, are a macroscopic representation of virtual particles, as above, so below. So I go to the Dogon descriptions of this spiral of matter and realize that they are a point-for-point match for scientific descriptions of Barnard's Loop, which is considered to be a what's called a stellar bubble, that the process by which it forms, the shape that it forms, the expectation that it's going to eventually burst, these are all a match for what the Dogon say about their spiral of matter. So when the Dogon say that their spiral is a counterpart to that, they're right on point. They've got it exactly right. And this is another structure that we can't see with the visible eye, but they preserved references that led me to it.
Right. And then the pyramids themselves are left kind of as a keynote for us to be able to decipher and do the mathematics.
Right. And my friend Ed Nightingale has a very insightful book. It's called The Giza Template. He spent this guy is a master wood carver. I mean, he's restored artifacts for the Vatican, among other things. He spent 20 years reverse engineering a plan for the Giza Plateau that explains, it predicts where the structures will be placed, how big they should be, what angles the pyramid should be at, why there's a causeway at this angle, and so forth. And it all ties to cycles of rotation in the macrocosm above it.
So we're talking about matter and non-material planes and how these two interact and how they, throughout the cycles of time, reach new stages. And then these new stages alter all of civilization on planet Earth. And I'm thinking a little bit about right now as CERN had sent up a device to the International Space Station called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And this was a device that sees the anti-universe. Now, strangely, it was built by a company called Grawlator, and their corporate logo is a reptilian claw, which is just kind of bizarre. But we can see where CERN openly admitted, hey, we're punching holes through the other dimension and something may come through. I mean, that was a CERN scientist saying that. And then we're watching as things like the Norway spiral open up over an ionospheric heater like ISCAT, you know, as Obama's going to get his Nobel Peace Prize, right? They decide to punch a hole into the other dimension and transmit something through it. So I'm watching things like when they sent a Doritos commercial using an ionospheric heater to Alpha or to Ursa Major. You know, we sent a Doritos commercial to Ursa Major.
You know, I had heard there was a shortage of those there.
Yeah. You know, they all need Doritos out there, right?
Yes.
And then we sent The Day the Earth Stood Still, the movie with Keanu Reeves, the remake, off to Alpha Centauri. And it actually arrived in Alpha Centauri December 21st, 2012, because it took 4 years to get there.
Okay.
And so we're building these abilities as we learn to break down matter and create matter through photons, right?
Right.
So we've gotten to a point now where we can not only capture antimatter for an extended amount of time, but then we can also take photons and turn light into matter.
Right.
You know, and so now we're getting into Star Trek teleportation ideas.
Well, I know a physicist who should know, and he says everything you saw in the first season of Star Trek already exists.
Right. Now, again, there we have Gene Roddenberry sitting in a seance with people like the Astors and channeling the Nine, as they knew them, to get this information. And we know that Gene Roddenberry took a lot of this information about the Nine and in these seances and integrated that into the Star Trek stories.
Now, it's also interesting that the energetic relationship between the non-material and material is characterized as, okay, the terms that are used is grasping, holding firm, or establishing. And the animal image that associates with that is the claw of a bird of prey that grasps things.
Right there with the girl later.
Yeah, so your reptilian claw is a correlate to that.
Yes. They know, right? They know. These guys at CERN, these guys punching holes in the other dimension, these guys, you know, at the relativistic heavy ionic collider colliding gold and causing time dilation.
Yep.
They know. They had these secrets,
and
right?
There's a way of objectively demonstrating that they do know things that they're not saying. If you think that the amount of time that elapsed between the first flight of the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk and the invention of the space shuttle is about the same amount of time that has elapsed between the invention of the space shuttle and now.
Wow.
Now, during that span of time, every electronic device you can think of has gone through quantum improvement. Just compare a desktop telephone or a payphone in a phone booth to a smartphone.
Right.
Compare a cathode ray TV set to a flat screen TV set. Every single device I can think of that's electronically related has gone through this, or technologically related, has gone through this quantum improvement during that span of time that's equivalent to when we went from no airplanes to supersonic transport
right.
and space shuttles. Okay. visibly in the universe, outwardly, the way it looks in terms of space travel, the new Orion capsule that they announced hasn't moved 2 feet off the mark of the Apollo capsule. They actually canceled the space shuttle program. My feeling is that simple logic, understanding that the space program should have had priority, not been put last, that there's every reasonable reason to think that they have actually made those same quantum improvements in all that technology, but have done it privately and not publicly.
So space travel rockets are unnecessary at this point.
Right. And so they canceled the space shuttle program because it was no longer worth the cost of maintaining the sham. That was just there to make us think that we were still doing stuff when we were, the stuff we were really doing was secret.
Right. Yes, we have moved leaps and bounds, and a lot of it, you know, doesn't seem correct to me. And I want to talk to you a bit about where we're at now in the hourglass as far as material, immaterial planes, because the way, I mean, we're making quantum leaps almost daily now in technology and in just the way we see the universe. It's too much for me. Like, I don't believe Steve Jobs sat in a garage and built a computer. It just doesn't compute for me that all this technology that's so beyond, because I like you came up through all of this. Like, I think back to my granddad, who was an original engineer on the trains before the gold spike.
Uh-huh.
And he died watching the space shuttle launch.
Wow.
You know, so that's one lifespan.
Right.
And now here we are. I mean, we're jumping Jesus every other week in a new quantum dynamics and quantum entanglement with reality. And, you know, we're all moving to the cloud and moving into this AI nightmare technocracy. It's all just too much for me to believe that humanity suddenly came up with, oh, well, let's try this. And of course, a lot of this came through the Nazis. And we know the Nazis also were doing rituals, contacting entities. You know, right. They talk about it openly.
Yeah, they were certainly connected to traditions in India, right. The same tradition in India.
Yes.
So now that leads us into another aspect of this. The question is whether, from a strictly scientific point of view, a traditional scientific point of view, there's any indication whatsoever of the presence of a non-material universe. Well, there actually is. And one of the direct ones is, it floats with a concept called fundamental particles. Stephen Hawking says that there are more than 200 fundamental particles. The Dogons say there are 266. Now, the Dogon, like modern astrophysicists, categorize these particles by their symmetry, what the particle looks like basically from different sides. There's one type of particle that looks the same from all sides. That's a class of particle. There's another class of particle that you have to turn around once for it to look the same. That's like a double-headed arrow. Another class of particle that has to be turned all the way around to look the same, that's like a single-headed arrow. And there's a fourth class of particle that actually has to be turned around twice in order to look the same. Now, that's the class of particle that has the potential to be slipping into a blind spot for us and then slipping back out of it. That what we're seeing overtly on the material side, as we turn it around, somehow, you know, turn it all around once and somehow it doesn't look the same as it originally did. That does not make sense in the dimensionality, the rules of dimensionality we're used to. So that class of particle has the potential to point to the presence of a non-material universe. What I compare it to is if you were a young student driver learning how to drive a car and nobody ever pointed out to you that there was a blind spot created by the system of mirrors. You might go through your entire career of driving and never realize that you weren't seeing everything in the mirrors.
Right.
You might not realize that under the right circumstances, you can hide a tractor trailer truck in the blind spot.
Right.
Okay. science to me has the same kinds of blind spot based on certain assumptions they make at the fundamental levels of things about where dimensions really come from, things like that. These assumptions that you need to be able to measure things in a particular and a consistent way, there are some caveats to that. And they've created these blind spots where science doesn't allow for a thing to happen that we all experience. And these are the whole class of paranormal, that we call paranormal experiences, that look for all the world like they're real experiences or have some reality to them. They don't really play by the rules of normal life, but science shuts an eye to them. It doesn't say, well, there's this whole realm of things we don't completely understand yet. They say that's not possible.
Right. Even though thousands of people have seen it.
So one of the things I finally thought to ask after 20-some years of working with this stuff was, there's sacred geometry in its simplest form falls back down to a geometric plan that's used by ancient cultures to align shrines to north, south, east, and west. It's a pretty simple set of progression of steps, geometric steps that create this geometry. In Buddhism, they say that geometry reflects how space actually emerges. It recapitulates how space actually emerges. So I ask myself, is it possible that that plan, that sacred geometry plan in its simplest form, could be the geometry of something? Because you can represent many of the processes of astrophysics as geometry. So I did some research and I discovered, guess what? It's the geometry of the very kind of particle I was talking about. The particle that has to be turned around twice is called half spin particle. It has to be turned around twice to look the same. The geometry of that particle is the geometry that's used to align these shrines. That same geometry is also the geometry that's typically used to represent how time works. So we have another indication here. There's really a perspective from not only is the sacred geometry representing how space emerges, it also reconciles why time is an arrow and how time merges hand in hand with space.
Yes. Because time is a conundrum.
Yeah, time is a conundrum.
You got the Pope's time, you know, the clock.
Yes.
And then we know that time exists, but how to quantify it? You know, a clock certainly isn't quantifying time. It's a false time, I would believe.
Right. I mean they get ever more precise about measuring time. But now if we go back to our metaphor of the swirling energy, where we're imagining the implication of that metaphor is that time is persistently slowing down on our material side and persistently speeding up on the non-material side. There are two effects of that I want to talk about because they're important here also. Scientists looking through their telescopes look out into the universe and they look further and further and further and back in time. They see galaxies that formed closer and closer to the Big Bang. And they do their math, and they run their calculations, and they say, you know, we can see that the rate at which the universe is expanding has been speeding up. We don't understand why. They postulate dark energy and things to explain what's pushing the universe to expand more and more and more quickly when it should be slowing down. From my perspective, what they're seeing isn't the rate of expansion of the universe speeding up. They're seeing the effect of their own time frame progressively slowing down.
Now, would that give us the result here? Because it seems to me like time has sped up. I mean, a lot of people agree with me on this idea.
Yes.
That it seems like, you know, days are flying by. Time is flying by so much faster.
Right.
Would that be the result?
Well,
from our perspective?
It could be that a similar dynamic plays out over the span of human life, because everybody I know feels like as they get older, time speeds up.
Right.
My wife Risa says that it's kind of a toilet paper effect, the toilet paper roll effect, that when you're 1 year old, A year represents the entire span of your life. When you're 10 years old, it represents a tenth of the span of your life. And so your frame of reference on a unit of time changes as you get older.
Okay.
So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that, as I said, the same dynamic that causes time in a universe, time frame in a universe to speed up also plays out biologically, because they're in the Dogen mindset, the Dogen are trying to represent three stages of creation or three themes of creation: how matter forms, how the universe forms, and how biological reproduction happens. And they say that those three themes are so parallel to each other. They demonstrate that they're parallel to each other by representing all three themes simultaneously using a single progression of symbols. And so, of course, the symbols are complicated because you can't take a symbol and say, what does this symbol mean? You have to ask, what does this symbol mean if we're talking about biological reproduction? Or what does this symbol mean if we're talking about the universe? And they're parallel meanings, but they aren't precisely parallel. If we're talking about biological reproduction, the hemisphere represents the expanded womb of a mother. If we're talking about the formation of matter, a hemisphere represents the expansion of mass. Parallel concept sits in the same place in the continuum, but not precisely the same meaning.
Right.
So that's one half of it. Now, the other half of it is on the non-material side. As time frame quickens and quickens and quickens and quickens, here's what one of the effects is. I live 3 hours north of New York City. If I wanted to go to New York City, I could choose a number of ways to do that. I could walk, which would take me forever. I could ride a bicycle. I could hop on a horse. I could drive a car. I could get on a train or a bus. If there were a bullet train, I could take that. I could hop on a plane. I could hop on a jet plane. I could get in a supersonic aircraft. And each one of those would get me to New York City in a progressively faster pace. Now, if I could move from Albany, New York to New York City in an instant, then it would be as if there was no distance. The distance would have no meaning anymore. It's like what we see on the internet, that I can talk to somebody across the country instantly as if they were in the room with me on the internet. Effectively, space doesn't have meaning if you can quicken time frame enough. And so on the non-material side, as time frame quickens, the effect you're getting is one of entanglement. Entanglement is a situation where time frame runs so ultra quickly that the space no longer has any meaning. It's as if everything were one thing. And as you slow down that time frame, when you an act of perception, when somebody perceives a wave and they accelerate that wave and they impart mass to it as they accelerate it and they slow its time frame as they accelerate it, suddenly that space that was already conceptually there to begin with starts to have meaning. Before that, it didn't. And the essential difference for me between the non-material and the material is quickness of time frame.
Right.
Now, if you look at quantum effects in relation to quickness of time frame, all of the mystery and all the quantum weirdness evaporates. It doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. All we're doing with wave collapse is by perceiving the wave, we're causing a chain reaction that progressively slows the time frame of the thing we're seeing. And a translation happens that's quicker than the digital image appearing on your TV set. And now that thing that had been wave-like appears to you as a particle.
Yes. Welcome to the quantum world, right?
Yes.
Such a new mind frame.
So that's the basic dynamic of what's going on for me. Now, the way the cycle works is one universe, the more material one, is becoming progressively more massive, and its time frame is progressively slowing down, 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 down. The other universe, at the same time, is time frame is progressively quickening, and events are happening faster and faster and faster until it reaches a point at the end of the cycle where everything happens at once for the non-material, and the non-material is said to have perfect knowledge because everything happens at once. It's like the difference between a cassette tape and a CD. On a cassette tape, if you didn't have a fast forward button, you would have to listen through to the tape all the way to the song you wanted to hear. With the CD, you can jump right to the segment you want. Now, what happens on the non-material side during this cycle is the non-material side, about a third of the way into the cycle, figures out what's going on. If you have a consciousness in an ultra-quick time frame, there's an equivalent state for a human being. It's called locked-in syndrome. There was a book and a film made a few years back by a man who had locked-in syndrome. It was called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. This is a man in France who had suffered a stroke at the wheel of his car and had a car accident. And they thought he was brain dead, and they took him home to care for him. And he was still able to blink his eyes, but they didn't see any intelligence behind that. It was just random blinking. Well, one of his aides figured out that there was a pattern to it and that he was still in there, perfectly conscious. He just couldn't move. It's a horrific state, like being buried alive, unless you have a compatriot. And she worked out a system with him so that he could blink his eyes to indicate a particular letter he meant, and then he could spell out words to her. And he ended up writing this book one letter at a time with her help. The non-material side figures a third of the way into their cycle that that's where things are headed for it. It's going to effectively be buried alive. If we believe the Hindus and the Buddhists, it would be buried alive for around 4,600 years. I'd say it's a multiple of 1,200. So 4,800 years. So the only remedy to that, the only way not to make that horrific, is if you have a compatriot, someone who, like the aide, who knows you're there, knows that you're having a hard time expressing yourself, who's paying close attention to your attempts to express yourself, and is sensitive to them, and sorts them out. So the non-material side, a third of the way into the process, decides, okay, it understands that at the point where it's going to be locked in, those on the material side are going to be furthest removed from any knowledge whatsoever that they even exist, because that's the way the yuga cycle works, is that material sensitivity to non-material things gets progressively worse and worse and worse in this cycle. So at the very point where the non-material needs a compatriot most, the material is least able to be that compatriot. Right. So the material side says, if we want a caretaker when we're in this condition, we need to create a structure for humanity, for civilization and humanity, that preserves the memory of the fact that we're here. So that there's, and more than that, the esoteric tradition is sort of designed to select out the sensitive, sincere caretakers from the people who aren't.
So those are the people that are receiving these synchronistic messages.
Right. The people who pay attention to them, the people who choose to pay attention to them, it's like if you're at a party, you know, if you were from Eastern Europe and you went to a party in New York City and nobody spoke your language, and then you realized that one guy over in the corner sort of spoke a little Ukrainian, you'd spend the rest of the night over next to that guy trying to talk to him.
Right.
That's what happens with the non-material. When the non-material gets a sense that someone's paying attention and is starting to understand, these subtle attempts, the subtle attempts, according to Samkhya, are, they come in the form of vivid dreams, synchronicities, the unusual behavior of animals, divination and clairvoyance, telepathy, all the things you think of as being paranormal, have the potential to be, according to Samkhya, deliberate efforts by the non-material side to communicate, either communicate knowledge or induce an action. The people who pay attention to those foster it to themselves, because suddenly you got somebody paying attention here. Let's try to communicate with this guy.
I think I'm one of those people. Do you?
I would have, out of the box, quote unquote, at age 18, I would have thought that I was the least connected person on the planet.
Right.
Because whatever happens for me happens in such a transparent way that I don't even notice it.
Yeah, if you were at the right place at the right time all the time, would you ever know?
That's right. It took took sort of hitting me over the head to get me to realize that things were going on. synchronicities and non-material type stuff happened a lot with my wife's family. At first, I was the person who was saying, no, I don't think so. And she would explain to me some experience that had happened to her or to one of her mother or to her grandmother or to an aunt. Slowly over time, things started happening for me, for our children, and eventually reached the point where I was the one things was happening to, and my family members were the ones saying, oh, no, that couldn't possibly be, until they witnessed. I mean, certain of these are very objective occurrences. Early in my process, in the 90s, before you could go online and look for out-of-print books, I was looking for a particular reference book. And I had exhausted all the local sources, the used bookstores, the new bookstores. I had even gone to Vassar College, where I graduated, and went to their interlibrary loan service to find out, could they get the book for me? And they came back and said, no, sorry, we can't get it. And so I finally had to concede to my wife that I was never going to find that book. I was going to have to move along without it. 2 days later, a box turned up on our back doorstep. She had an aging cousin who lived in a high-rise apartment building in Queens, New York, small apartment. And every so often, he'd reach critical mass with stuff and throw a bunch of random crap into a box and mail it off to some relative as a way of divesting himself of stuff. Huh. Well, in this box, and my wife says, you know, Flags of the Nation, Hot Mitts, coasters, and my book.
It's just the kind of thing that you can't describe to people. It's one of those things where if you don't experience it, you don't believe it. And if you don't believe it, you don't experience it.
Right. But this was objective enough that.
Yeah, it's right there in your face. I mean, you got goosebumps. I guarantee you got goosebumps.
The important thing for me was that I couldn't ignore it. I had to allow that there were things going on my behalf that I couldn't explain.
Yes, exactly. And we're going to get deeper into that in the second hour. We're going to talk a little matriarchy, patriarchy, how this shift is occurring, where we're at in this current cycle, and whether or not the communication is getting more and more open or more and more closed, and whether or not you guys out there listening are listening to your own inner synchronistic being and having these divine messages come through your genetic coding, which it seems to be. Because, Laird, we have run right through this first hour already, and I am just thrilled to death. I can't help it. This makes me as giddy as a schoolboy talking about this kind of stuff. I love it.
Well, I do too. Thanks.
But so the folks know, your website is innertraditions.com.
Right. That's my publisher's website, or they can find my books at simonandschuster.com, or really pretty much anywhere. They're on Amazon. You can normally find recent books in Barnes & Noble. You can order them through any bookstore. You can find me on Facebook. Don't mistake me for all the other Laird Scrantons out there.
Is that right? No. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yes. Folks, you want to get these books. They are detailed. They are going to open up ideas and concepts that take some time to process. If you're into it, understanding hieroglyphs and these ancient symbols, and then taking this into etymology, and of course comparative cosmology, to understand that there has been messages from the other side being transmitted to humanity throughout millennia. A lot of this is coded in our DNA, as we're going to see in the next hour. A lot of these messages are being dropped in our lap through rare and wondrous synchronicities that suddenly drop books that you need in your backyard, and realize that this has been going on all along, and that this message has been trying to be transmitted down, and that it has gotten confused to the point that if you were to see a Dogon in his typical ceremonial mask, you're going to think extraterrestrial. But we got to realize that the term extraterrestrial has now changed and now incorporates this concept of interdimensional communication, right?
Right. Properly for me, inter-universe communication, but there's also dimensionality and difference in time frame associated with it for me. The UFO phenomenon very much conforms to this dynamic of crossing that boundary between non-material and material.
That absolutely seems the case. And we're going to pick that up, folks, on the other side, get into some of the genetic coding I got from the synchronistic message from the Dogon symbols, and even a little more into Freemasonry. But mostly, I want to talk with Laird about this shift from the matriarchal to the patriarchal and how it moved through these cultures, and then how that really occurred. And I'm sure Laird has much more ready to lay out for me to excite me in these type of crazy topics that us from the other world seem to enjoy. You know, this is so important. And yet it lays out everything. And who would know that you could go from mud hut tribes to CERN and be speaking the same language?
Yep, amazing.
Amazing. So, folks, stay tuned. If you're not yet a member, please come on over to freemantv.com and subscribe. Keep this show going. I hope to keep it going maybe another decade. Who knows? You know, 13 years now, another decade. We should be pretty good with that. I hope to hold on that long and keep this going. So please come over to freemantv.com and subscribe and get this second hour, as it's always so much more fun because I feel like we're off the stage and just in with the family, and we're all just hanging out. And members, if you're listening to this on the free side and you can't seem to access your members side, please let me know immediately. I can fix any problem instantly. So members, if you're having any issue at all, write me at freeman@freemantv.com and I will, I'm my only employee, I will get you all squared away very quickly, very simply, and it'll all be no problem whatsoever. So come on over, check it out, see the 13 years of archives, realize that in the members section, you get it all, you get deep into everything, and it's a lot of fun. So I hope you'll join us over there. Laird, I hope you're ready as we jump into a lot more fun when we get into our little family section. And we will see you all next week.